Nancy Terry says, let's talk point blank about familiar faces and places. That's what they call me, Nancy, and I've been tearing around town this week to get the latest lowdown on the high spots in the entertainment world. First, let's take a look at the land of gossip and glamour. Hollywood producers estimate that a really good title for a motion picture can make as much as $50,000 difference in a producer's profits on a picture. A good title must be brief to fit theater marquees. It must have action, it must be dynamic, and it must stir the imagination. Of course, it doesn't hurt to have a good picture with it. I wonder if you folks know which play has enjoyed the longest run on a Broadway stage. Well, I won't keep you guessing. It seems Life with Father tops the list with well over 3,000 performances. And Oklahoma has been the most successful musical play with well over 2,000 performances. Rita Hayworth, who skipped out of Hollywood for her marriage to Dick Hames, has already lost three choice roles to other actresses. Now she's reporting headed back to Hollywood to chat with her Columbia bosses to find out if they are her bosses or her ex-bosses. Maurice Chevalier, the noted French comedian singer, will soon combine business with business when he comes back to our country for a brief spell. He's not heading for Fort Knox. Fort Knox will come to him. He'll get around $20,000 for a two-week stint at a nightclub in Las Vegas, Nevada next spring. And that's just a little pick-up pocket money. Where he'll get the mint is when he goes to Hollywood to supervise the making of his life story with Danny Kaye playing the role of the famous Frenchman. Robert Taylor and Eleanor Parker had to study Arabic for their co-starring roles in The Valley of the Kings, which is being shot right now in Egypt. Our Orchid Award of the Week goes to ski-nosed television actor Lynn Osborne, who may propel through the outer space as Cadet Happy of Space Patrol, but who had to give his hardest real-life performance before a bunch of scoffing kids. Cadet Happy, as any kid knows, has suspended many a villain into rigid and speechless animation on the United Planets of Outer Space. But one day, and this was not in front of a TV camera, the tables were turned on him right here on little old Earth. Cadet Happy and the entire Space Patrol cast had been visiting a Hollywood high school all decked out in their fancy outer space uniforms. After their show, they went out to his automobile to head back for the studios. That's when Cadet Happy became unhappy. When they piled into the car, they discovered it wouldn't start. They learned the horrible fact the battery was dead. So there was only one sensible thing for the Space Patrol men to do, and that was the same thing that plain old Earthmen would have done under similar circumstances, and that was simply get out and push. So five members of Space Patrol with tomato-tanned faces pushed Cadet Happy's coughing used car past a long line of homeward-bound kids, all laughing, of course, and jeering, "Fire rockets, fire rockets." Cadet Happy bought a new car, you can be sure, the very next day. Hollywood, the heart of the entertainment world, is made up of people of many good habits. It's also peopled by a few with bad habits. And I'll be the first to admit that many styles are set by the citizens of this glamour town. We all know that. What many a girl wears on the screen today will be the vogue for m'lady tomorrow. I'll go along with that habit for a lot of reasons. But one thing I don't buy is the phony snob appeal the stars of stage, screen, radio, and television try to create by endorsing this or that article and thinking we will form a line to buy that article just because that star says he or she uses it. So for this bad habit, we give our Lemon Award of the Week to the entire entertainment industry. Our lemon is sliced equally among the guys and gals of the glamour business who lend their names, for a fee, of course, as an endorsement of a product. It's even seeped into the society section where Mrs. Gottrock tells us that poor mortals, that's what we are, of course, just the way she uses this or that brand of soap. Well, I don't particularly care. I don't think you do either if Paul Douglas smokes a certain brand of cigarette, for example. In fact, I personally don't care if he dips snuff or chews tobacco. And the fact that Gloria Swanson says she uses a certain soap to make her body more glorious, may we say, doesn't make me want to tear off a wrapper and get a similar bar of this or that soap. A little scrubbing will make most of us come clean with anything but soft soap. I frankly doubt that any thinking person would buy a particular cigarette just because some actor or actress claimed that brand was his or her favorite. I admit advertising pays, but not really the phony kind. It's so fine tonight, we have a special guest in the studio. I think maybe our table's a little wide here, Ruth. We're both going to kind of have to bend elbows and move in. But it's so nice to introduce Miss Ruth Moore, reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times and authoress of the new book about which so very many people are speaking, Man, Time, and Fossils, just published by Alfred A. Knopf Incorporated. Really, Ruth, if you don't mind my saying so, I'm afraid that title kind of baffles me. It sounds deeper than I think I could digest. What do you say?
Well, it does sound like it covers a lot of territory, and of course it does. But behind these big words, which cover a lot of territory, there are some of the most exciting stories, I believe, that are to be found anywhere. And I would say that some of the things that happen beat anything that you can read in science fiction or some of them even in detective stories. And all my job was just to dig them out and to tell them.
I like that fact. I'm very glad you mentioned that your stories will beat detective stories and science fiction. I mean, for the idea of their fascination.
Well, I'm not quite saying that myself. I think several reviewers have said it. And Mr. Walter Yost of the Encyclopedia Britannica in his review said so. The New Yorker said so in their review. And also, I believe, in one of the Cleveland Press reviews.
Well, it proves the same thing. It proves, Ruth, doesn't it, that really truth is stranger than fiction. That's why I like that
review. It really is. Things happen that are completely improbable that you could never dream of, and nobody ever manufactured anything quite as dramatic as some of the things that have occurred in this long struggle of the scientists to tell us the story of our origins, tell us why we're alike and why we're different, who our ancestors were, and how we have come to differ from them.
And it's certainly so much more gratifying to read a book that tells us how strange truth is than to read a book, however strange, and realize that it's just fiction. I think it's much more gratifying.
Well, they both have their place, perhaps.
I want you to tell us something, if you will, Ruth, about Piltdown Man, because he's come back in the headlines lately.
Yes, he really crashed the headlines in a big way 2 weeks ago, and he's been in them ever since. And he still isn't through. If you've noticed, the cartoonists are having an awfully good time with him. The New Yorker had him on the spot again this week. But as an example of what I said of detective stories, there, Piltdown Man, he takes one of the prizes, I do believe. Back in 1911, there was an English lawyer named Dawson who was walking along a road when he saw that it was being mended with some rather unusual brown flints. He knew they didn't belong there, so he asked where they'd come from, and that led him to a gravel pit. And as he began examining the material that had been taken out of this pit, he found a piece of human skull. Well, that seemed very strange, but he knew about fossils and realized it was a fossil skull, so he kept watch. Later, he found another piece of this skull. And then some of the most outstanding scientists in England joined him in a search of this gravel pit. And there, about a year later, they found a piece of a jaw, a most unusual jaw. It looked like the jaw of an ape. But it just was there, and you had to deal with it. But so they put together this skull of Piltdown Man. They took these little pieces of skull and this jaw and put them together as well as they could. And Sir Arthur Smith Woodward, who made the first reconstruction, came up with a man who had a brain of about 1,200 cubic centimeters, which is much less than the size of our brain. But Sir Arthur Keith, another noted English anthropologist, said, "This isn't right. This skull is a little bit lopsided, and our skulls are not lopsided, and I'm going to reconstruct it in another way." And he did, and he produced the skull of a man with a brain of 1,450 cubic centimeters, which would let him live today. In fact, would let him graduate from college today, I'd say. And but a good many people said, "Well, this couldn't be. This couldn't be. You can't take a few little pieces and put them together and say this is what the skull was." And Sir Arthur Keith said, well, he would prove that you could. He then asked for a test. And so some scientists cut up the skull of an Egyptian woman. They cut up a few little odd-shaped bits and pieces. And they were no more revealing than the pieces of the Piltdown skull and gave them to Sir Arthur Keith. In 2 days, he had reconstructed the skull, and he had the skull exactly right when it was compared with the original, because they had kept the measurements of the original. Mm-hmm. So that sort of gave Piltdown man some standing. And they decided that he was probably the first modern man. He was the first man known who had reached our brain size. So, however, they had decided, through some other evidence, that he belonged to a period of about 500,000 years ago. Many noted authorities had agreed upon that. But again, there had never been any scientific way of proving this. Just opinion. It was well-based and carefully studied opinion, but still it was just opinion. And it stood that way for more than 30 years, until the end of the war. And at that time, Dr. Kenneth Page Oakley of the British Museum was doing some work with fluorine. And he saw that the longer a bone stayed in the ground, the more fluorine it would absorb. And so he decided to test the Piltdown bones. He tested the bones of Piltdown man. He tested the bones of an extinct kind of elephant that was buried in the same bed. He tested the bones of a beaver, which lay in the same gravel. Well, to the amazement of almost everyone, including Dr. Oakley, there was very little fluorine content in the bones of Piltdown man. He had no more fluorine content than the beaver, whereas the bones of the elephant and some of the other animals were very, very full of fluorine.
And that brings us pretty much today in the enigma, doesn't it?
Well, that made his jaw look very improbable, and it led to this retesting, which disclosed that the jaw was the jaw of an ape and not the jaw of a man.
Well, a kind of crashing realization in the field of science, no doubt.
Oh, it was crashing. But it has established the fact that Piltdown man is very young, that 50,000 years can certify him. It has established the fact that the jaw, and meaning our brains and our jaws and ourselves, have followed a steady line of evolution. There hasn't been any strange swingbacks or throwbacks to the ape. Very reassuring finding, let's say.
Ruth, oh my goodness, your stories are so fascinating, and this is only one of the choices in your book. But we'd like to know what incited your desire to write the book.
Well, it really started out with outer space, with carbon-14, you might say, and the work that was done there, and the discovery that this carbon-14, which is created by atomic explosions in the outer atmosphere, enters into all living matter. And by measuring how much of this radioactivity any living thing or any dead organic matter has lost, you can set its age. And so for the first time, they'd found a way to date man and all remains for the last 25,000 years. So I wrote that story.
And that started your interest in the book.
And that started eventually that led to evolution, and there went the book.
Well, we know that there are so many fascinating facets of it. And by the way, Ruth Moore is working on a new book right now on the life of Darwin. But we'd like to suggest that this is a fine book for Christmas gift giving, because I know it would appeal to anyone. I mean, to people of all ages, really. Particularly since it is definitely written in layman's language. I'd like to stress that, and I'm sure that you can all judge that from Ruth's conversation about it. It's not written in scientific terms, and yet it brings clearly to all of us a great deal of the realities of science. Thanks, Ruth Moore, for being our guest tonight.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Pleasure to be here.
We're so pleased you shared a visit with us tonight, and we hope you'll invite us in again next Sunday night at 10:45 for another point-blank airing of Familiar Faces and Places. We'll have some more lowdown on the high spots in the entertainment world. Now, Nancy Terry says, good night.